You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Today, we'll be hearing more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. We'll also be talking to award-winning flash fiction writer Ingrid Janjewski about why flash is where it's at, the saviour of the universe. But our studio guest today is Umi Sinha, author of the fantastic time slip novel Belonging. Hello, Umi.
Hello.
Thank you for coming on the show. Flash fiction. Have you ever written any flash fiction?
I tend to write long. I started off writing short stories and they were always 5,000 words plus. So really, I'm a novelist. But I did once win a weekly online competition for flash fiction, £20. For a story of 100 words. It had to be exactly 100 words, but that's the only time.
£20's not to be sniffed at.
No.
They're very precise. I was going to say, it's a good way to get into writing, but actually, it's a very precise form, isn't it? Where every word counts.
It's like poetry, I think, and I've never written poetry. I think that kind of absolute precision with words is beyond me, really.
And we'll be hearing later from young writers at the start of their career. Did you always want to write? Was it something you did when you were younger?
From the age of about 6, I think, I started writing. My mother was a writer. My brother's a writer. So it's been in the family for a long time. We were surrounded by books. I grew up in... my father was a naval officer in India, and we grew up on this inland engineering naval base in this very beautiful hill station. And there was absolutely nothing to do. It was so unbelievably boring, my childhood. My sister and I weren't allowed to go out and roam around the way my brother was. And I just read, basically. So I think reading and writing were the two things that kind of kept me going, really.
And you teach writing as well.
I do.
There's that big question, is can it be taught?
I think you can teach the technique. I don't think you can teach people to write if they don't have any ability in that direction. I think, you know, it is really like anything. It's about technique, and how good the person is really depends on their own ability. But you certainly can become a very competent writer, I think, from any standard, really.
Make people the best they can be.
Mm.
Well, we'll come back and give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first track of music now, which is One Meatball. Why this one?
It was, my mother had a collection of 78 records when I was a child, which was played on a kind of wind-up gramophone with his master's voice, the little dog listening. And this was one of the records. And as a child, I found it absolutely heartbreaking. It's about a little man who goes into a restaurant and he's only got 15 cents, so he can only afford one meatball, and the waiter humiliates him and refuses to give him a piece of bread with his meatball. It used to make me cry when I was a child. And I think because I was growing up in India where there was a lot of poverty, it really kind of woke me up to the inequality and the unfairness of the world.
One meatball he could afford, but one meatball. He told the waiter near at hand the simple dinner he had planned.
Oh, that is a sad song. There's Josh White and One Meatball, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Umi Sinha. Umi teaches creative writing at New Writing South and runs her own courses and workshops for writers, as well as being a mentor. Belonging is her first novel. Anthony Quinn, judge of the Authors Club Best First Novel Award, described it as hugely affecting. It was shortlisted for that award, longlisted for the Historical Writers Association Goldsborough Debut Crown Award, and recently shortlisted for the Waverton Goodreads Award. In 2006, Umi co-founded the Guesthouse Storytellers, an oral storytelling club. But we'll go back to those awards, Umi. I say it was recently shortlisted for the Waverton Goodreads Award. It's very recent, isn't it?
Yesterday.
Congratulations on that. How important are such shortlistings and long listings, particularly for a debut author?
Oh, very, I think. And it's very hard to assess, really, what effect they have. But, I mean, any publicity is good publicity, basically, isn't it?
And the awards, particularly, that are chosen by the readers, which the Waverton Goodreads.
Yes. I mean, I think the book is one that... I get a lot of emails from people, which apparently is quite unusual, through my website, telling, you know, individual people emailing me saying they read the book and how much it moved them, and, you know, maybe they have some connection with, their family has connection with the colonial period. And I really love hearing from people. And I do a lot of book clubs as well. A lot of book clubs are reading it and inviting me to come and talk to them. And so I get to hear, as a storyteller, I just love hearing other people's stories. It's so nice to have that coming back, because I think as a writer, quite often, your book goes out there and that's it. You never really find out what people think of it, apart from the reviews on Amazon or whatever.
So for people who haven't read Belonging, can you describe it to us?
Well, it's set between 1855 and 1919. In colonial India and in Sussex. And it's the story of three generations of one family. And I suppose the theme is really the struggle of trying to escape the patterns of family history and the trauma of some historical events as well. And I think even when people don't know what's happened in the past, it still affects them and affects their behaviour.
Yes, I mean, I feel you slightly underplayed it there in that description, because it is quite an epic novel. You know, you span three generations, mm-hmm. two countries, you've got three narrators using three different forms. You have letters, diary, and straight narration.
Mm-hmm.
You like a challenge.
Yes, it was actually very stupid as a first novel to choose something so ambitious, and it did take me a long time to make it work.
Why did you come to telling the story that way? You know, how did you get there, choosing those three characters, deciding it's going to be over that time and in those forms?
Well, the colonial subject matter, I think I chose because I wouldn't exist if it wasn't for colonialism. My parents met in 1945. My father was over in Britain during the war and served on the Arctic convoys. And at the end of the war, he was at Chatham Dockyard. My mother was from Strood in Kent. And he met my mother at a dance. And she went out and married him in 1948. So he would never have been here if it hadn't been for the Raj and all that. And I think also the feeling of belonging that's very... is the major theme of the novel. And that's been a big theme in my own life, because I've never felt I really belong anywhere. And I've realised as I've grown old that is actually can be a really positive thing. But for a long time, I struggled with that and kept trying to find somewhere where I thought I might be able to find some sense of belonging. So those were two of the reasons. The form of it, well, I think I chose big historical events partly because I was interested in them, and I have some tenuous family links to both the First World War and the Indian Mutiny. And... sorry, my mind's gone blank.
No, it's all right. Well, I'm going to push you a little bit on the form, because the form that you're talking about there, because we have the straight narration, the diary, and the letter, which are all very different to write, I would imagine, and all offer something different to you as a writer in what you can show about a character.
Mm. I think I chose them because the story is so big and there's so much material that, in a way, if you're writing diaries and letters, you have to keep it concise, because people don't go into really lengthy kind of descriptions and things. So it made it manageable. But I think also I just wanted to experiment with different forms and see what it would be like, and the different voices.
And did you like it? And was it something that, was there one particular form that you liked, the letter or the diary? Or did they all offer something?
I think I enjoyed writing Henry's section the most, which is the diaries. Probably felt closest to him because a diary is quite an intimate form. Letters are written to someone else.
And how did you write it chronologically? Because we do have these three different times, the three different generations. Did you write, you know, say Henry's story all at once? Or did you flick between chapter and chapter? How did you keep track of it?
Yeah, I had lots of charts on the wall and post-it notes and arrows and, you know, all sorts of mechanisms for keeping track of it, but I still lost track of it quite a lot of the time. I think I wrote Cecily's, the first narrative, the grandmother, in her letters pretty much in one go. In some ways, they were the easiest to write. Then I wrote some of Henry's, and then I started working on Leela, the granddaughter, the narrative, and I found her the most difficult to do. And then I think I kind of, yeah, Cecily's I had to be cut down a lot. The other two narratives I sort of worked on side by side, really, because at some point I realised I couldn't just write three separate stories. They had to keep interweaving.
And they do keep interweaving. And obviously they're all telling a bigger story as well. So that was always in your head when you were writing the individual lives.
Yes. And I think the fact that you've got three narratives and Leela doesn't know what's happened to the previous two generations mean that it's a bit like a detective story in the sense that there are clues in the other narratives that then get revealed in one or the other. So There are a lot of little hooks, I think, in it that kind of pull the reader through. That was one of the things I wanted to do with that very complicated structure.
Oh, they certainly are there. And there's a big question that you leave till very near the end. Well, we're going to come back to how you did stretch it, how you managed it. But we'll hear now, as I say, from writers really at the beginning of their career, more winning entries from the Rock Road Library writing competition. The brief was location as inspiration. Entrants were asked to write about a place in Cambridge. The Corpus Clock by Thomas Bullen was a winner in the 7 to 11-year-old category. But we'll start with a winner from the 12 to 16-year-old category, Four Seasons by Bahavna Kahulisa.
The weak green leaf hung from the tough high branch. The leaf stood out in the sea of brown, red, orange and yellow on the ground. The last leaf. The last leaf to turn colourful for this beautiful fall season. And the last leaf to hang from the tall tree. Autumn was always the best season to take a walk through Cherry Hinton Park. Not only was the weather warm with a light breeze, but the crunching sound of leaves under people's shoes and the squirrels running around before hibernation made the park welcoming and calm. All leaves had mutated their surface to beautiful autumnal shades, and all trees had lost their leaves, becoming naked and ready for winter. All but one little bright and alive green leaf. The leaf seemed to be holding tightly to the branch, not wanting to join the others that lay on the ground comfortably. It seemed to be holding ever so tightly to one of the highest branches on Muffin, the tree. Nonetheless, as a strong wind blew past, it made the leaf wobble and wiggle, and it gave up and fell to join the others on the ground. Only it did not. As the leaf descended, it suddenly stopped. It had landed on something. More like someone. The girl knew something was on her head as she laughed with her friends. She quickly reached her hand up and over her head. Her small, thin fingers brushed over the smooth surface of the leaf and she pinched a corner of it. She examined the leaf carefully for a few minutes, spacing away from the present. The conversation going on in front of her felt like it was miles away, and the loud, clear voices were now nothing more than a whisper. A cough from one of her friends snapped her back into reality, and she dropped the leaf to the ground. The only odd fish in the sea of brown, red and yellow fishes. The only green leaf at the bottom of Muffin, the tree. The snow gently lay on the naked branches of trees and short grass. Children running around covered from head to toe with gloves and coats and heavy clothing to keep the little body heat they had in. Weird-shaped snowballs flew everywhere, making the big plains of snow-covered grass a massive snow battlefield. Kids screaming, dodging, pushing each other around and running everywhere. The same group of friends made their way over to Muffin, trying not to slip and fall over. Muffin was covered in white, melting snow, and the teenagers thought better than climbing on it. The sky was not enticing, as only fluffy grey sheep covered the colossal field above. The group of friends decided to join the traditional fight of boys and girls and snow. Their booming voices and laughs echoed around the park. The kids dropped their bags at the foot of the tree so they could run and dodge better. They were soon sprawled on the floor, breathless with all the fun they were having. The girl got up and started rolling a small ball of snow around until it was no longer small, but at waist height. The others got up and helped her create a second ball, half the size of the first one. On the count of three, they lifted the smaller ball and placed it perfectly in the middle of the bigger one. They all went searching for bits and pieces and managed to make a face for their friend, Snowman. They all lay back down and decided to create snow angels. They moved their arms around their bodies and heads. They all sat and talked, and while some were busy running around and chasing each other, others could barely move their limbs for laziness. The condensed air appearing in front of their mouths blurred their words and laughs, and they knew nothing could have made that winter evening any better. Nature started growing back as all the snow melted and winter left. The weather got warmer and the animals came back from their hibernation. The flowers started blooming, making the park colourful and pleasant. Bees and wasps started buzzing around looking for flowers, and the grass grew back, becoming taller. The holidays were over and school started again. Cherry Hinton Park was becoming busier. The trees were growing their leaves back, and slowly but surely they all came. All apart from one leaf. It was the same leaf that was green during the autumn and now late to grow. The leaf was the smallest on Muffin. The days passed and the leaf didn't grow past the size of a baby's hand. And while all the other leaves were bright and green, this leaf was emerald with a streak of ruby running across the surface. It could be seen from far away. One cloudless day, the group went over to Muffin. Their book-filled bags were scattered on the floor and they lent their bikes on the trunk. One of their phones blasted some catchy pop tune and they all hummed or sang along to the melody. Even though they were one of the smallest groups in the park, they were surely the loudest. They all smiled and giggled at the lame jokes they cracked and just enjoyed themselves as if they were in their own little world. They all climbed on the intricate and twisted branches. Some chose the higher branches where you could see the sky clearly. Others stuck to the lower ones and admired nature by paying attention to the finer details. Either way, they all found their assigned spaces and made themselves comfortable. Muffin became like their second home. The last day of school. This meant no more homework, no more classes, no more strict teachers and annoying classmates for a whole month. Everyone cheered and sighed from happiness when the last bell rang. The group met by Muffin one last time before the summer holidays. Everyone had their own plans and they were all going to other countries or parts of the UK. They met at Muffin to say a final goodbye until the next school year started. It wasn't a sad goodbye hug, but more of a I won't see you for a while hug. The street leaf hung from the high branch, the smallest leaf on Muffin and possibly the smallest leaf in Cherry Hinton Park. It looked magnificent under the filtered light. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Shake, shake, shake. Fall, fall, fall. The radiant leaf fell on the girl's head, interrupting the group hug. Once again she grasped it before it fell to earth. They all admired it. The girl held the fragile leaf cautiously and crouched down until she sat on the grass. She put the leaf next to Muffin's root and dug a thin little hole, not caring about how muddy her hands were and that everyone was staring at her. She explained that the leaf would always be remembered along with all the memories they had created during the year around Muffin. She said the year was one of the best she'd ever had, filled with the people she loved, and she would never forget them. She placed the leaf in the hole and covered it with earth. Then darkness took over. Community radio in your city. Cambridge 105.
The corpus clock, it ticks and it talks. You'll never find a clock like the corpus clock. The corpus clock, the corpus clock. No, you'll never find a clock like the corpus clock. But have you ever heard of the ghost of the corpus clock? Legend tells that a Komodo dragon once visited Cambridge and saw the clock, and then it happened. It crawled inside, and what a surprise! The gears churned it stone dead. He staggered forward and closed his eyes and took a rest on his permanent bed. So next time you visit the corpus clock, you never know, he could be a rock resting on the corpus clock. The corpus clock, it ticks and it talks. You'll never find a clock like the corpus clock. The corpus clock, the corpus clock. No, you'll never find a clock like the corpus clock.
And The Corpus Clock by Thomas Bullen was read by Helen East, and Four Seasons by Bhavna Kahulisa was read by Lindsay McCauley. You're listening to Bookmark with me, Lee Chambers. Our studio guest is Umi Sinha. Umi, just listening to those examples of young writers, really, and the rhythm of the language there, which was lovely, particularly in the poem. I was thinking the rhythm of the language of each of your narrators. How did you, because Henry would talk very differently to Cecily, and how did you get inside their heads, I suppose?
That's a difficult one. I mean, with Cecily, she's an older generation, so the language is a bit more towards Georgian, I think, than sort of early Victorian. Without overdoing it, I wanted to convey a sense of that, but also she's a very kind of bubbly person by nature, but she gets caught up in these terrible events and her character changes and develops, I think. But a bit sort of frivolous and silly as well to begin with, I think. Henry was a much more serious person, but also I think as a child, my mother had a huge collection of Victorian novels and I read a lot of Victorian books as a child. And I think those male voices particularly, because a lot of the books were told from a male point of view, stayed with me. So it's interesting that I find Victorian men quite easy to write.
That's your specialism.
Yeah. And the attitudes, to some extent, are quite familiar to me as well.
Well, yes. I mean, the position of women for a lot of your novels was very different to what it is now. What research did you do on that?
Gosh, I did a huge amount of research. Well, the suffragette movement comes into the book as well. There was a lot more about it, and I took most of it out because there was just too much history in the book. And then Vicky Blunden, my editor, said, why don't you put back some of that stuff about the suffragette? So that was nice. I think I got a paragraph in there. But yes, I think the position of women changed a lot around the period when Leela is young, just before the First World War, when, you know, the suffragette movement was at its height, the, you know, 30 years or so before that. And I felt, you know, that with the war narratives, it's very much male dominated, although there is women's experience in it. And I wanted something that actually also focused on what was happening in, you know, the women's movement at that time.
All right, we'll listen to your second choice of music now, which is The Animals and House of the Rising Sun. Why this one?
When I was a child, we used to travel back and forth to England, and we always travelled by cargo ship, which was actually much nicer than a passenger ship, much more interesting. And I remember when I was about 9 coming to England, it was during the Bay of Pigs invasion, so it was a very tense time. There was a young boy on the ship, he was about 18, I had quite a crush on him, called Benny, can't remember his surname, Anglo-Indian boy, and he was coming to Britain to try to be the next Cliff Richard, and he had the most beautiful velvety voice, and he used to sing House of the Rising Sun and other songs like that on the ship. And I often think of Benny and wonder what happened
what
to him.
What became of Benny,
Because
yes.
he didn't become famous unless he...
Unless he changed his name.
Yeah, even then. I can't think of any really famous Anglo-Indian singers other than Cliff Richard, so...
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our studio guest on Bookmark is Umi Sinha, author of Belonging. And Umi, you're going to read an extract from Belonging for us now.
Yes, it's close to the beginning of the book, and it's from Leela's narrative. Leela Lillian Langdon is 12, and at the beginning of the book, she's living in Peshawar in what was still then India, with her father and mother, and there's a tragic and very violent incident in the first section, which I won't tell you about, and... As a result of that tragedy, she's put on a ship to England and brought to Sussex to live with her great-aunt Wilhelmina. And on the ship, as a sort of in an act of defiance at being sent away from home and of grief, she stops speaking. The first thing my great-aunt Wilhelmina said when she met me off the boat was, "You may call me Aunt Mina, and I shall call you Lillian. As for India and the past... we shall never speak of either again." I had opened my mouth to greet her, but I looked up into her cloudy brown eyes and closed it again. I stared out of the window as we drove to her house. It was the middle of August and everything was unfamiliar. The sun was a hazy glow behind a pale grey sky. There were drab people walking along empty streets and no colours or smells. Even the sounds were tinny and unreal, and I was cold, colder than I had ever been, although they told me it was summer. And I'll skip a bit about the description of the South Downs. Inside the large house, I felt stifled by the thick muffling curtains and soft carpets, the heavy dark furniture and brooding silence. In India, my window had always stood open at night, and the voices of the servants, their laughter and quarrels, and the smell of their cooking drifted in on the warm night air. Here my room was on the first floor at one end of a long corridor, and the rest of the floor was empty, except for Aunt Mina's room at the other end. At night no sounds came up from below, and the silence was so profound that I imagined that everyone had died, and that I would wake up in the morning and find myself alone. Night after night, I had the same dream, which I still have sometimes. It is dark, and I am back in Peshawar, walking up the drive to our bungalow. It lies quiet, its whitewashed walls glimmering in the moonlight, punctuated by the shadowy rectangles of its windows and the open front door. I go inside and walk through the empty rooms. All the furniture is gone, and I can feel sand blown in from the desert, gritty under my feet. In my bedroom the windows stand open. The muslin curtains float upwards, and the strong, sweet smell of Raat Ki Rani drifts into the room on the night air. Hindus believe that when you cross the ocean, which they call the Kalapani, or black water, you lose your caste, and your caste defines your place in the world, where you belong, and ultimately, who you are. You become an outcast. My own experience, even though I am not a Hindu, tells me that this is true.
Well, talking of own experience there, how much of that was based on your memories? Because you were saying earlier you spent the first 10 years of your life on a remote engineering base before moving to Britain. Do you remember those first impressions?
I do. I remember I was 15, actually, when we moved to Britain, but I was 9 when we came for the first time. I remember arriving at Surrey Docks, which is on the East Coast, actually, and it was that pale grey sky, and I remember looking up and thinking, why is the moon out in the middle of the day? And saying to my mother, why is the moon up in the day? And she said, that's not the moon, that's the sun. And then driving along, we drove down to Kent. My uncle came to pick us up. And it was so quiet, and the streets were so empty, and there were all those little houses and very grey. And I remember feeling that it was sort of ghostly almost, it felt like. But of course, now I live on the South Downs and it is so beautiful. You know, I was just telling you earlier about the drive from Eastbourne to Brighton along past Beachy Head and Cookmere Haven. And the countryside is stunningly beautiful. But I don't think I appreciated it then.
Well, no, as a young child. And I'm wondering how much of those early years and your parents' life as well, you've always wanted to put into a book, because you mentioned your father earlier on, and there's a lot about the role of Indian soldiers there. Mm. Was that something you always knew you would want to write about?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the reasons I chose historical events was when I thought I wanted to write a novel, and it seemed such a big undertaking. I thought if I chose a historical period where lots of dramatic things were happening, it would kind of provide me with a ready-made plot, which it did to some extent. There was also a big downside to it, of course, because when you've got that many big dramatic events in a book, it's very easy to go over the top on the historical detail. And of course, you have to tell the story through the characters and their experience. So yes, I had to cut a lot of it out, but
there are big events in the book. There's the events at Cawnport of 1857, which I'm ashamed to say I didn't know about. That was very shocking.
It was very harrowing, I think, the experience, and it's probably one of the few periods in history where the British had the experience that many refugees are having now. You know, of being trapped, of being shelled, of being starving. Thrown on the mercy of the local population, who weren't particularly, you know, apart from isolated incidents, supportive.
Yes, they're basically cornered in a ruined building, an old fort or something. And
well, it was actually just an entrenchment. It was a piece of waste ground. They built a low wall around it, which someone, one of the soldiers, described as low enough for a cow to jump over. And there they were in this open space, surrounded by buildings, being, you know, cannonballs flying in, and, you know, it was
waiting, really.
Yes, terrible experience. So, yes, there was that, and then there's the First World War, and that's told from the point of view of the Indian soldiers on the Western Front and in Mesopotamia.
And the book's been released in India.
What's
been the reaction there?
Well, I was slightly worried because I was thinking Indians might feel, why did you write it from the British point of view? But in a way, what I wanted to show in the book was, you know, it's fairly obvious what the effect of oppression is on the victims. I wanted to show how damaging oppression can be to the people doing the oppressing. And I think it's very clear in the book the damage it does to that particular family.
And what was their reaction to that?
Very positive, actually. It's had very good reviews in India. And I was at the Tata Literary Festival in November and did two readings. I took part in a panel discussion with a historian from Dublin University and a writer called Raghu Karnad, who's written a book about three of his uncles who were killed in the Second World War. And it was fascinating, really fascinating. And I also did a reading. And yes, very, very positive responses to both.
Good. That must have been a relief to you.
It was.
Well, we're going to hear something slightly different now. Ingrid Jędrzejewski has only been writing flash fiction for 3 years, but she's already carved out quite a name for herself. She's won the Gigantic Sequins Flash Fiction Non-Fiction Contest, the Bite Size Enlightenment Contest and the Orlando Prize. She's currently on the shortlist for the Bath Novella Award and was recently a judge for the Flash Fiction Day competition. Here she is, reading a piece of her flash fiction called Tornado Warning.
The town's tornado siren is blaring, so we're taken down to the belly of the school, a cavernous basement room smelling of overcooked lunches and gym socks. We kneel in rows, bend over, put foreheads to the floor, clasp hands over the backs of our necks, and we wait. A funnel has touched down southwest of us, but worse than that is Angie Maynard's plimsolls up against my head. There's gum on her shoe, and it's sticking in my hair. I push against her feet, let her know I'm there, but she pushes back. For 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, forever, we battle it out. By the time we're allowed to stand, shake our limbs, something has formed between Angie and me. Something that wound itself up through volleyball season, something more devastating than any tornado. It darkens, emerges with us from the basement. Then it begins to twist.
So that's flash fiction.
Yes, that's flash fiction. That's 152 words.
152 words, but it packs a punch, that.
Yes, yes. It tells a whole story in a compressed form. You get a sense of narrative, a sense of movement throughout the piece, but yet it's only 152 words, a couple paragraphs.
And how long did that take you to write?
Well, the first draft, I probably got down in a half an hour or so, but then I edited it for several days before it finally ended up in this form. Then I sent it to the A3 journal, and they sent back some changes, and I edited it some more. So,
because people might assume that because it's only 152 words, it doesn't take you very long to write. But I guess the opposite is true, because every word has to earn its place there.
That's true. And oftentimes it takes a long time to write yourself into the story. I very often cut about 25 to 50% of a story that I'm trying to write before it's in its final form.
So how would you describe flash fiction generally to somebody who's never come across it before?
It's a tricky one to define because lots of people think of it in different ways. The main definition is that it's a short, very short story. Usually it's defined by word count. It's almost always under 1,000 words, often under 500. For certain things, people are looking for stories that are only 50 words or 100 words long.
50 words? How do you get something into 50 words?
It's very tricky. It's very tricky. If you approach it in a similar way to how you'd approach writing a poem, where you're trying to make the most use out of every word you're using, then that's a way in to those shorter forms.
But there has to be a narrative, does there? Because a poem can often just linger on a moment. With flash fiction, there does have to be a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Not necessarily. It helps to have some sort of sense of movement throughout the piece, perhaps a sense of change. Some pieces are very narrative and do have that start, middle, end. Some of them suggest a start or suggest an end and leave a lot to the reader to fill in the gaps. And some of them are more similar to prose poetry or these forms. They show a moment or maybe a vignette.
This seems to me a fairly new form of fiction, is it?
I think people have always been writing flash. You've got fables and folktales and fairy tales, which are often quite short. Writers like Kafka and Borges have written short pieces, which would now be considered flash fiction. But it hasn't been till very recently that it's become quite popular. Now there are quite a few journals who especially look for short fiction, and there are a lot of contests for flash fiction, whereas about 10, 15 years ago, the term didn't even exist. I think, you know, the people were looking for terms. People used to call it short. It wasn't really considered a very respectable literary form.
It does seem to have become more popular. And I wonder if one of the reasons for that is that you do get an entire story in that short length of time. So you don't have to dedicate yourself to a novel. You don't have to commit, but you can get the satisfaction nevertheless.
That's true. Yeah. And you can pack quite a few of them in a literary journal or online. I think a lot of journals now have moved online. And so it's a perfect form for reading on the screen.
So how did you come to write flash fiction?
I started writing it before I really realized flash fiction was popular. I did some creative writing when I was younger, but it wasn't until I had my daughter I came back to writing. And at the time, I was trying to write a novel and failing miserably. I was trying to write in these little snatches of time while raising an infant. And I wasn't able to keep a coherent narrative going. I went to Flash Fiction essentially as exercises to help me tone up my writing. So I was writing character sketches, little scenes, descriptions, and then I found I really enjoyed writing short pieces for themselves. And so very soon I stopped thinking of them as exercises and thought of them more as finished products, and then started sending them out. And at that point, I started reading Flash Fiction, realized what the Flash Fiction landscape was like out there. There's tons of stuff out there. Lots of different journals, lots of different styles. There's genre Flash Fiction. You can write your Flash Fiction romance or mystery story. And there's also, more prose poetry oriented, just all sorts of things, literary fiction.
What are the advantages for a writer of Flash Fiction?
One of the biggest advantages I find is that you can try out lots of different ideas, and you can get something down in an afternoon or even in an hour, half an hour. You try an experiment. If it works, great. If it doesn't, you haven't invested the time you would have invested if you're writing something longer, like a novel or a short story.
And I guess the disadvantages are that it can be a little frustrating. Or do you find it actually a good discipline?
I find it a good discipline. I really enjoy writing them. You really can play with some things that certain ideas that just you couldn't keep a reader interested if you were writing an entire novel. I recently wrote one. It was a story about teaching mathematics in the form of a mathematics syllabus. You couldn't take that and make that a novel, but you could try it out and see how it works in a piece of Flash.
And you can see the writer's own stamp. Even though it's a short piece, you can read something from a writer and know very definitely it's their work.
Oh, definitely. Yes, yes. Much like poetry. It's very similar to poetry in that sense. Not only does every word count, but you have to very carefully construct your sentences. And so you can see people's signature styles.
And does it lend itself to performance, I suppose, to being read out because it's so short?
A lot of times, yes, yes. Although if you go to an evening where people read nothing but Flash, you need some breaks in between. Otherwise, the stories start running into each other. So,
now, you've recently been a judge for the National Flash Fiction Day competition. As a judge, what were you looking for in the entries that you saw?
Well, one of the main things we look for is a very tightly constructed story where there's nothing extra that doesn't need to be there. It's whittled down. It's streamlined. It has an excellent title, an excellent beginning that just draws you in, and then an end that sums it all up or takes it to a different place. We're looking for stories that resonate well after you read them.
There's also an anthology that's emerging from the National Flash Fiction Day. What would they be looking for in that?
They're looking for pieces of up to 500 words each on the theme of life as you know it. Entry is free. You can submit up to 3 pieces. And there are a couple editors who will select usually quite a few stories for an anthology that will be published and probably released on National Flash Fiction Day, which this year is the 24th of June.
And 500 words, is that a lot for Flash Fiction? What's the longest a piece of Flash Fiction would be?
Probably the longest would be 1,000 words, but 500 is a pretty standard cutoff.
And you have had a story that was just one word long.
That is true, yes. In fact, it placed in last year's National Flash Fiction Day microfiction competition. Oftentimes, your title doesn't count in the word count. And so I was playing with how much of the story could I put in the title and leave very little for the actual text of the story.
Okay, you're going to read another piece of Flash Fiction for us now. Can you tell us about this?
This is a very different piece. This is a little less narrative and a little more playful. It's called Rain Cloud, and it's 206 words long. Yesterday, I became a rain cloud. I hadn't realized that it was a democratically elected position, but then there are a lot of things I don't know about nature. The sun put me forward, and the horizon seconded the nomination. I had a bit of trouble winning over the mountains and prairies due to my lack of experience, but the vote swept in from the stars and forests and tides, and in the end, I came out ahead by a decided margin. So I quit my job, informed my family, then took off my clothes and ascended to the heavens. It's cold up here, but the winds say I'll get used to it. I've managed to look reasonably gray and foreboding and have floated menacingly over pedestrians and picnics. However, I have yet to figure out how to rain. There's something about it that seems so impossible, so unlike anything I've ever done. But the universe seems to have confidence in me. It will come in time, says the sun. Just let yourself go, say the stars. After all, says the horizon, humans are made of water, and there is sadness ahead. Raining isn't so different than crying. You just do it with your whole body.
That was Ingrid Jędrzejewska there, reading another piece of her flash fiction. We're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, Umi Sinha. It's been nice to chat to you. Ingrid was talking there about performance. You're very much involved in storytelling. As we mentioned earlier, you formed this storytelling group.
Yes, there's a storytelling club in New Haven called the Guesthouse Storytellers, which has been running since 2006. So.
And what is it about that that appeals to you? There's something about the spoken word.
I think it's very immediate and very live. I mean, as a writer, you're spending years labouring over something and then it goes out into the world. I've been lucky to get feedback, but often you get no feedback. With storytelling, you've got that live connection with the audience and there's immediate gratification, you know, when they appreciate your telling. But I think stories are also a really good way to convey information and messages and wisdom indirectly so that you can kind of parallel what's happening now in an old story, and it's delivered in a kind of non-threatening way that people are able to listen to without feeling that they're being asked to think about something that they might have a position on. So I think it's it's one of the oldest art forms, and I think it is actually very rich still, but it's very little known. You know, I know there have been storytellers like Ben Haggerty and Sally Pom Clayton and Hugh Lupton, who have been probably for about 30 years now rebuilding storytelling in this country. But I think because the word itself is used in so many different contexts, people still don't get it. So I think people still think storytelling is story reading, rather than the fact that you just stand there and tell a story, improvised. You know the story, but you improvise the words as you tell it, live every time.
So what's next for you after this book, which has had such a good response? Are you writing another?
I am writing another, and it's sort of linked to this book. I won't go into the details, but it's set in Second World War Italy. So I'm planning to do a trip to Italy in July to do some research. It's rather daunting. I'm not sure why I do this to myself.
It's not another one that requires research. Well, we've been talking today about Belonging by Umi Sinha, which is published by Myriad Editions, a small publisher who punch way above their weight, don't they, Umi?
Yes, they're a fantastic publisher. I feel so lucky to be published. They're so professional and so lovely and nurturing to their authors as well. You know, all the editors have become good friends.
And this is a beautiful looking book. What a beautiful design on the front.
Yes, that was Anna Morrison, the cover design. Again, I feel amazingly lucky. It's really a beautiful book.
And what about you? What are you reading at the moment?
I've just finished reading George Saunders' Lincoln in the Bardo, which is an absolutely brilliant book. I mean, I think, you know, when you're a child and you read books, you read them with a kind of immediacy and a lack of critical kind of faculty that makes them very immersive. But I felt with that book, I was admiring the technique, obviously, as a tutor, as I was reading it. But it's so original and so moving and so funny as well.
Right. Well, we'll come back to you just to get your last bit of music in just a moment. But just to preview the next show, we'll be talking on the next show. Our studio guest will be crime writer Elizabeth Haynes. We'll also be talking to book sculptor Justin Rowe and hearing more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. All previous episodes of Bookmark are available as podcasts if you go to the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Umi. This is something from a film, A.R. Rahman and Cello Cello. Is that how it's pronounced?
Cello Cello.
Why this one?
Well, the film is set in colonial India, and it's about a kind of evil British tax collector who wants to double the grain tax at a time when there's a drought. And it ends up with him challenging the villagers to a cricket match. And if they win, they don't have to pay any tax. But if they lose, it's tripled. So their survival depends on it. So it's quite a funny film. And the music in it is wonderful. And this is when they, you know, they're kind of getting their spirit up and they're, you know, building their morale and they're sort of going out there to really fight the fight.
Thank you, Umi. Lovely talking to you today.
बार हा बोलो यार हा अपनी जीत हो इनकी हार हा बार बार हा बोलो यार हा अपनी जीत हो।